Yeah, I appreciated, I don't know how Artur Vardin introduced the day. Felt like he really set the scene well. And it's been quite an interesting experience sort of preparing this talk over the past few days, because there are a number of people who were going to be here, who wanted to come, but then for various reasons have had to pull out at the last minute. So I do feel like I've just been getting email and text like over the past couple of days of like, sorry, can't come because of this. And that's quite, it's just been quite interesting, I think, in terms of writing a talk about Sangha in the sort of ever-changing sands of the Sangha. It's sort of been quite a good reminder of the, I don't know, the insubstantial nature and the transitory nature of what we try to create as a Sangha. And like Artur Vardin said, you know, Sangha and friendship are just really dear to my heart. I've been working here in the centre for the past 12 years, firstly in Earth Cafe and then for the past 10 years in the centre itself. And I do feel like that's been my main work in a way. It's just been trying to help to deepen friendships for myself and for others. And I do feel like that's a main part of what I do as Mitra Convener, is try and work out, you know, do people want a deeper experience of Sangha and friendship like I do? And if they do, how to help them and help myself sort of deepen that as a practice. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And I am going to be a little bit provocative in the talk at various points. So I suppose I also feel like my role as Mitra Convener is to just try and create a bit of a dialogue about this whole area in particular, and what it is, what it means in practice, and whether we do want it, you know, and what that then means. So I'm going to start with a short passage from some of the earliest texts in the Pali Canon from the Sutta Nipata, which is a great collection of suttas. And this is from the last chapter, the chapter of the Way to the Beyond. They travelled through the land of the Alakas, coming first to Patitana, then to Mahasati, Ajeni and Ganada. On they went to Vidisa and Vinasa, to Kasambi and Saketa, until they came to the greatest of all cities, Sarvati. From there they set out again, this time for the land of the Magadha. They passed on their way through Satavya, Kapilavatu, and the town of Kusinara. They went on to Parva, to Bogangara, the city of wealth, and then to Phasali, where they came to the beautiful Pasanaka Chaitya, the rock temple. They climbed up the mountain path with the zeal and the haste of a merchant drawn to wealth, or a thirsty man to cool water, or a man with sunstroke to shade. And there, with the order of monks gathered all around him, sat the Lord, the Blessed One. He was explaining the Dharma to them. The lion was roaring in the jungle. Ajita saw the man full of enlightenment. It was like the sun shining without burning. It was like the moon bright and full on a full moon day. So I wanted to start with that extract to just explore an initial question, which I think is important. And the question is, what is it that draws people together to form a Sangha? You know, how does a Sangha sort of come about? So in that passage, you get this description of, there are 16 students of the Brahmin Bhavari. And Bhavari tells his students about the existence of the Buddha. He's heard about the existence of this awakened being. And the 16 students then go out on this journey. So from that passage, I think you get this really vivid sense of, you know, that long sort of section of like going from city to city, town to town. They go on this long journey to meet the Buddha, because they've got questions to ask him. And I think you do get this, you know, it's a long journey and it requires effort. I think you get a sense of that effort that they're making to go and see and meet the Buddha. But I think you also get the sense of these students sort of have these sort of existential questions. It sort of comes out later in the sutta, you know, because the sutta is basically just their questions to the Buddha. But you do get this sense, I think, of that they're looking for some sort of respite, for some sort of shelter. Not from the journey itself, although I'm sure they did need that, but from their suffering. They're looking for some sort of respite and release from their suffering, and that's why they want to meet the Buddha. And then they find the Buddha, and again, you get this very beautiful imagery, I think, of the Buddha. Well, the Buddha's light, you know, the sun shining without burning, the brightness of the full moon. So they've now found that sort of light. They've found that brightness of the Buddha and his teachings. And that light is shining again, you know, as the sutta goes on, you get this sense of this light shining on their questions that can, you know, that is releasing them from their sort of confusion and sense of suffering. So I think you could say that a Sangha forms around that light. It sort of forms around this brightness of the teachings of the Buddha. And that light shines on the suffering that everybody, you know, that everybody who comes to Buddhism is bringing. I think they, you know, on the whole, people are bringing their questions, in whatever way it is, about their own suffering. So here in Manchester, 2,500 years on from that description in the sutta of the students meeting the Buddha. You know, that's what happens here. I'm sure that's been all our experiences, that we've come to this centre looking for something. And that'll be different for all of us. I know for me, you know, the questions I brought was like, in the face of my loved ones dying, you know, what does that mean? How do I make sense of that? That was the question I came to this centre with. And I definitely found something here, as I'm sure you all have, in your own way. And you could say that that is a light. It was the light of the Buddha's teachings that I found. And I responded to that in some way. But just as importantly as the light and the teachings that I sort of found, I also found others who were on a similar journey to me. And after a while of being involved, I could see that that light was also shining on others and being absorbed by them also. And as I got more and more involved, one of the things that I slowly began to realise, and I've been learning ever since, I feel like I'm still learning this, is that the experience of being with others in the Sangha is in fact a vital way of putting those teachings that I'd found into practice. I started to learn that it's actually within Sangha and friendship that those teachings become more embodied and can be lived out more fully. I slowly learned that my practice is relational. It's only in relation to others that I can really, you know, sort of see more deeply the truth of the teachings that I found. So through seeing that more clearly over the years and seeing that, you know, people come here with their questions, I've also seen that, you know, myself included, we all come with our messiness and our differences and difficulties, you know, our different backgrounds and temperaments, our different views and expectations. So I've also learned that Sangha isn't an easy practice. I think it's a wonderful practice, but it's not an easy one. And we do have to work at being a Sangha. We do have to work at friendship, you know, that both individually and one-to-one relationships. But as a whole, as a body of people, I think we do have to work at it, you know, as a body of people practicing together. And this was true in the Buddha's time also. And one of the things I've been referring to quite a bit in this talk is this fairly new book, which Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of the main translators of the Pali Canon, brought out, I think, a couple of years ago. It's called The Buddha's Teachings on Social and Communal Harmony. It's a fantastic book, and really encourage you to get a copy of that and dip into it. It really shows, I think, some of the aspects of Sangha as a practice. But in that book, Bhikkhu Bodhi describes the Sangha as an intentional community. a community that brings people together under the banner of a shared purpose or common ideals. And intentional communities usually set up boundaries and have principles, rules and regulations to help them to stay in harmony and to help them stay cohesive. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the Buddha was very interested in these principles because the order that he set up brought together men and women from different geographical areas, different castes, and with different ideas and attitudes. And also, the Buddha was the guide to a larger congregation of lay followers who were spread out over a very large geographical area. So for the Buddha, maintaining the principles and the cohesion of his community was therefore really important. And the Buddha had to lay down rules for behaviour and conduct and had to give teachings to help preserve harmony and cohesion and to help heal conflicts in the Sangha. And there are a set of short suttas in another collection called the Anguttara Nikaya, or the Numerical Discourses, where the Buddha describes the differences between a Sangha that is actively trying to maintain harmony and cohesion and a Sangha that isn't. So the Buddha describes, for example, monks, there are these two kinds of communities. What two? The divided community and the harmonious community. And what is the divided community? It is where the monks take to arguing and fall into disputes, stabbing each other with piercing words. And what is the harmonious community? The community in which the monks dwell in concord, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with the eyes of affection. And as there are a number of like suttas that have the same sort of formula. And the Buddha describes quite a few other kinds of, two kinds of communities, the shallow and the deep community, the inferior and superior community, the ignoble and noble, the unrighteous and righteous. So we do get the sense that a community is something that doesn't just happen without any work. The Buddha's saying that we do have to work at being a harmonious and deep community. And one of the teachings that the Buddha gave in how to work at being a harmonious, cohesive community are what are called the four Sanghavatu. And this is beautifully translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi in that book as the four means of embracing others. I just find that a really beautiful image, this image of embracing each other to maintain harmony and cohesion. So that, the Buddha is saying that to deepen our sense of community, we have to embrace each other. It's not a cold or aloof teaching. We really have to hold each other and embrace each other. We have to be intimate with each other. So here's part of that teaching from the Sangaha Sutta. Monks, there are these four means of embracing others. What for? Giving, endearing speech, beneficent conduct, and impartiality. And what's meant by that is treating others as equal to yourself. These are the four means of embracing others. These means of embracing others are like the linchpin of a rowing chariot. So from all these suttas, you do get the sense that Sangha is a practice in itself and that we have to overcome our preferences, our different views.
Could you repeat that list?
Giving, endearing speech, beneficent conduct and impartiality, or treating others as equal to yourself. So we have to overcome our sort of preferences, our prejudices, our different views. We have to try and relate to others with respect and affection. Even if we don't temperamentally get on with them or find them that easy, we have to try and embrace each other. That's what the Buddha is saying. And of course, that's not easy, I'm sure. We've all got experience of this. I often cite the experience of being in the study group that I joined when I first started getting involved and just looking around the room and just thinking, I have nothing in common with any of these people. And of course that changed over the years. Sila Bodhi was in that group and is now a good friend, and Amla Varchi was in that group and is now a good friend. But that initial sort of response for me was like, I haven't got anything in common with these guys. You know, but I think also we can sort of get involved with the Sangha, and we think that it's, you know, we feel like we found our tribe. We feel like we found like-minded people, people who agree with us, who have the same values as us. But sooner or later, I think, you know, we will piss each other off. We will disappoint each other. We'll do things that we don't, you know, that others won't agree with, or that will be, you know, other people will do things I don't agree with. You know, we will be disappointed with each other. In his book, What Was the Sangha?, Sangharakshita says that being in deep communication and in relation with each other activates things in us that otherwise would be buried. So Sangharakshita says, meeting certain people can disturb aspects of ourselves. It can be a shock to realise what that individual has evoked in us, to find ourselves behaving in a way that we like to think is uncharacteristic of us, even expressing hatred or contempt. That unpleasant side of us was always there, but it needed that person to bring it to the surface. And conversely, Sangharakshita says that other people can activate resources of kindness and decency that we didn't know we had in us. Others will activate a quality of faith in us simply through contact with their own faith. So I just want to spend the rest of the talk sort of exploring in more detail sort of how we do embrace each other. Looking in more detail at this practice of Sangha. So there are three suttas that I'm going to use. And firstly, I just want to take the example of the relationship of the Buddha with one of his disciples, Angulimala. So there's a sutta called the Angulimala Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's a well-known sutta, and I've seen various sort of interpretations of this sutta. But the thing I want to go into from the sutta is just the aspect of Sangha that's about being deeply honest with each other and sort of really sort of having that opportunity to show ourselves to each other sort of deeply. Warts and all, and the opportunity that others can see our potential if we really show ourselves. So if you don't know this sutta, Angulimala is a serial killer. He's described as murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages and towns were laid waste by him. He was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland. That's what his name means, is garland of fingers. So you can almost see his sort of wicked moustache and him twirling his wicked moustache in that description. And in the sutta, you get this the story of the Buddha who's in Sarvati, and he's been on his arms round, he's collected food, and he's, you know, eats his food and then sets down his sort of bowl and robe, and then sets out on the road for, to walk. But the locals around him are all warning the Buddha not to go down this path because they know that Angulimala is around, and they're really fearful that Angulimala will kill the Buddha. But the Buddha just ignores them and walks on in silence. And then Angulimala spots the Buddha walking down the road, and Angulimala is overjoyed that the Buddha is coming down his way, and relishes the fact that here's the opportunity that Angulimala can kill, you know, this sort of awakened being. More twirling of the sort of wicked moustache. And then there's this remarkable passage in the sutta where the Buddha walks at his normal pace, and Angulimala is running and running to try and catch up with the Buddha, but just can't catch up with him. And Angulimala sort of shouts to the Buddha to stop. And the Buddha says, Angulimala, I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence towards living beings, but you have no restraint towards things that live. That is why I have stopped and you have not. And then Angulimala stops too, and has this great realisation, and he says, oh, at long last, this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake. Having heard your stanza teaching me the Dharma, I will indeed renounce evil forever. And so saying, the bandit took his sword and weapons and flung them in a gaping chasm's pit. The bandit worshipped the Sublime One's feet and then and there asked for the going forth. So I find that passage just really remarkable and just really beautiful. And I think what I find most striking about that passage is this sense that the Buddha has seen Angulimala very deeply indeed. You know, he's seen him on the deepest level. He's seen very clearly the suffering that Angulimala is causing both to himself and to others. You know, that Angulimala is just so full of craving and hatred, both for himself and other people, that he's really eaten up by that, and you know, that's why he sort of is killing so many people. And I think importantly, the Buddha sees Angulimala's potential and his potential to stop and go beyond his unskillfulness. It's a very profound scene by the Buddha, and Angulimala responds to that profound seeing. He's able to stop by being seen so deeply. I think it's a very tender response from the Buddha towards Angulimala. And I do think this is a really important aspect of Sangha as a practice and friendship as a practice, is the opportunity it gives us to be really deeply seen by others and to allow ourselves to, you know, to show ourselves more deeply. And I've seen that in my own practice over the years. I've seen, you know, that the more deeply I've let myself be seen by others, all my mess and all my unskillfulness, my own cravings and ill will, I've seen more deeply the spiritual potential of that. And I've come to see myself much more deeply through that as a practice. I think Sangha actually expresses this well, this sort of element of self-awareness and Sangha, in his book, What is the Sangha? So Sangharakshita says, the real significance of the deep individual to individual contact that going for refuge to the Sangha involves lies in a simple psychological fact. We get to know ourselves best in relation to other people. Through meeting the challenge of real communication, one comes to know oneself better. We cannot transform ourselves unless we have a full sense of what lies within us. And I remember in my own ordination process, sort of having discussions with my private preceptor, Moksha Priya. And he really saw that there was an ethical area of my life that he felt like I needed to understand more deeply and to try and change. And he really encouraged me to be more open about it with him and with other people. And through that act of being seen more deeply by him, and I've seen that I could be more than that behaviour that he was sort of highlighting, he was sort of pointing me towards. It enabled me to see much more clearly that through that sort of behaviour, how I was harming myself. And I just saw that on a much deeper level through that witnessing from him and from others. It felt like there was this profound shift in my relationship to that sort of area of my life. And it's been a slow progress to try and change that behaviour. You know, in some respects, I'm still sort of working on that area in my life. But, there has been this sort of shift that's happened through that being seen. And for me, I think it has been sort of putting myself into those contexts with my friends. So in this case, with Moksha Priya as my sort of spiritual friend and preceptor. But it's been also working alongside, you know, other Buddhists here in the centre, or being part of a study group, or being in a going for refuge group when I was training for ordination, or now being in a chapter, now I'm an order member, or being on retreat with others, you know, that sort of deeper seeing and deeper showing of myself has actually happened. So those contexts have really helped me to drop my defences much more. They've really helped me to take risks in communication. And through that, I've really deepened my sense of self-awareness. I know myself more deeply through that. And of course, those contexts have been where others have seen the best in me too. So where others have encouraged me and rejoiced in me. So one of the sort of traditions and practices we've got in the centre team, working here at the centre, is that whenever it's somebody's birthday, as a team, we sort of rejoice in each other And for me, that's just been a really sort of deep practice as the years have gone on. I think there is something about sort of being seen so deeply by people that I'm with day in, day out. And they've really seen sort of my positive qualities and my, I suppose, you know, allowed me to, or, you know, given me the gift of seeing the impact I can have on other people. Has really helped me to sort of, again, just quite profoundly, I think, to have a more positive view of myself. So it's a really important practice, I think, this sort of being really deeply seen by others. And this is one of the places in the talk where I just want to be a little bit provocative. So I suppose as Mitra Convener, I do get a sense of the health of the men's Sangha, and I think we're a good Sangha. But I think in this whole area, I think, you know, we could go deeper into this. I think we could be, you know, maybe we don't let ourselves get close enough to each other, as Artavardhan was saying earlier on. I think maybe, you know, the women's Sangha could be better at, you know, are better at this, and maybe there's more we could do in this whole area as men. You know, and I feel this in my own life too. I'm talking about myself in this. You know, I'm not sort of pointing the finger and, you know, I don't think it applies to me. I think it applies to me too. And maybe the first thing to do is just ask that question of ourselves. Is it what we want? Do we want to be in a in context where we are seen more deeply, where we show ourselves more openly? But I suppose if we do, I just want to encourage us to take risks and to try and go beyond what feels safe and comfortable in terms of being with each other, even if that's sort of messy and clunky. But it, you know, even, you know, with that messiness and clunkiness, there's an intimacy and a realness that can come from that. And I think that's what the story of Angulimala sort of shows, that, sort of an experience of the Buddha in relationship to other people that is just very deeply warm and deeply human. The Buddha shows that you can embrace somebody like Angulimala, and embrace him with a deep love and a deep seeing of his suffering and his potential. But of course, that's all difficult to achieve. You know, we might want that in principle, but the trying to get that is more difficult. I know that from my own experience. You know, it is difficult to really love each other. It's easier to keep each other at arm's length. And of course, things do go wrong in the Sangha. You know, there are often conflicts and misunderstandings, and we can end up hurting each other sometimes badly. You know, that has happened in our Sangha in Manchester and more broadly in Tri Ratna. So the next sutta that I want to sort of use to sort of look at that a bit more is the Kasambhya Sutta, which is again from the Majjhima Nikaya. So this sutta is about a group of monks who are in dispute with each other. I think the description of their dispute is just fantastic. So the bhikkhus at Kasambhya had taken to quarrelling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. So I think that's just great, you know, this sort of image of a group of monks who are brawling and stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It's just a wonderful sort of description. Just make me think, you know, have I experienced something like that in our Sangha? But the monks eventually calm down and meet with the Buddha, who gives them a teaching about six principles that create harmony and unity in the Sangha. So the Buddha tells them, bhikkhus, there are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, non-dispute, concord and unity. What are the six? Here, a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and private, towards his companions in the holy life. Again, a bhikkhu maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and private. He maintains mental acts of loving kindness in both public and private. Without making reservations, he shares with them any gain, including the contents of his bowl. Again, a bhikkhu dwells both in public and private, possessing in common with his companions those virtues or ethical precepts that are unbroken, unblotched, unmottled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. And a bhikkhu dwells in that view that is noble and emancipating and leads one to the complete destruction of suffering. And just as the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying part of a pinnacled house is the pinnacle itself, so too of these six principles, the chief is this view that is noble and emancipating. So the Buddha is saying that to stay in harmony with each other, we have to cultivate these actions of loving kindness in speech, action and our thoughts. We have to try and be generous towards each other and skillful with each other. But I think most importantly, we also have to cultivate right view. That's what the Buddha is saying. We have to sort of do all those things from the viewpoint of, a view that's more deeply and profoundly in line with how things really are. So I want to speak a little bit about the right view that underpins metta and metta practice, and something about metta as an insight practice. So one of the ways that Sangha can expose our delusion is that it challenges our wrong view that we are these separate, independent beings and that what we do doesn't really affect each other. So generally, from day to day, I go around thinking I'm this sort of fixed, separate being. There's me over here and you over there. And usually I do all that I can to protect that sense of self. And that sort of sense of, a separate sense of self. But I read the Dharma, I reflect on the Dharma, and it's telling me actually things aren't really like that. It tells me that, things aren't fixed and sort of independent in that way. It tells me that everything, including me and others, are in this sort of continual process, this sort of ever-changing flow of conditions. And that we and everything else are dependent on those conditions. And in this case, that includes me and you, that we are the conditions for each other. So therefore, we are interconnected in some way. We're not separate in the way that we think we are. And therefore, what we do in relationship to each other does really matter. Our actions do have consequences. This is what the Dharma is telling us. So metta and our ethical actions, our skillfulness, flow out of this deeper, profound seeing that we're not separate from each other. And of course, again, this is just really difficult to see. Like I say, I just go around thinking, oh, I am separate. It's not, my actions don't really have consequences apart from on myself. I don't always think of the consequences of my actions on others. So I think, in Sangha, it gives us this opportunity, because we are more deeply in relationship with each other, to see that more deeply, to see that more clearly, to see that our speech and our actions have a real impact on each other. So therefore, I think, in Sangha as a practice, we start to learn that our actions have consequences. That's the right view that underpins our practice as a Sangha. And in Living with Kindness, Sangha actually describes how we can break down our fixed sense of self in relationship to others in very pragmatic terms. So Sangha actually says, when we practice metta, it isn't that there are literally beams of metta radiating out from us, even though that image may be useful. It is more useful to regard metta as an outward movement of the self rather than from the self. As we expand the scope of our care and concern, the self is expanded. Our direct experience of ourselves should be that we are continually going out to be aware of and concerned for the well-being of others, not fixed on any single point of identity. And he goes on, a common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in abstract terms rather than as concretely lived attitudes and behaviour. Realising the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. If we find it difficult to realise the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is to try to be a little less selfish. So Sangharakshita is saying that metta is real metta is an act. It's not just a warm feeling on the cushion. And through breaking down our sort of sense of selfishness, real lived out metta takes us beyond the fixed sense of self. And one of the ways I've sort of felt like I've experienced something of this in my experience of being part of a Sangha has been around the whole area of apology and forgiveness. So there's this sense of my sort of fixed sense of self having to break down at times when I've had to apologise to others or forgive others. I can remember quite clearly, I think, before I got involved with the Sangha, just feeling very, very defended, and I can still be like that, but, feeling that very much more strongly, this sort of sense of feeling very defended. And I can remember at times in situations just really not wanting to apologise to others, just really wanting to hold on to, the sort of hurt that I was feeling or, the view that I had about myself and about somebody else. And I think practicing within the Sangha has just really helped me to break down something of that defensiveness. And sometimes that's felt physical, it's felt visceral at times, I think, that sense of breaking down. Almost like there's something within my body and within my psyche that is just breaking down on some level through that act of apology or forgiveness. And just really physically feeling my self-centeredness sort of starting to shift. I've got this going on, on some level, not a huge thing at the moment for some, with somebody. I am having to think about find creative ways to just try and forgive them for something. Talking with a good friend is really helping me to sort of work that out and to, break down any subconscious sort of desire to punish them or to just keep, the fixed view of myself and them in this situation. And I know that at some point I will have to sort of have a conversation, with this person about it. And I feel nervous about that. But again, I think in that nervousness or in the sort of dialogue I'm having with a friend about it, I can feel that sense of fixed self breaking down in some way. I can feel the sort of tectonic plates of my being sort of just, shifting away, even though it's, maybe just a little bit. So that's one way that we can break down our sense of fixed self. But I think it can also happen when we're in harmony with others too. And the last sutta I want to look at, again, is a well-known sutta. It's called the Chula Gesinga Sutta, which is once again from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's where the Buddha visits three monks, Aniruddha, Nandiya and Kimbala, who appear to be living in complete harmony. And they describe to the Buddha what their daily lives are like. So one of the monks, Aniruddha, says to the Buddha, "Venerable Sir, we are living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily, verbal and mental acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and private. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do instead? We are different in body, but one in mind." And then there's this beautiful description in the sutta of how these three monks are continually serving each other day in, day out. So Aniruddha sort of goes on. "Whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dharma. It's interesting for me in that sort of part of the sutta just how everyday, how ordinary those sort of acts are. You know, it's just all very domestic, isn't it? It's sort of cleaning things up, it's sweeping the floor, it's emptying the latrine bucket. So it's not this exalted activity, it's not sort of all singing, all dancing, it's not, you know, fireworks. But it's just something quite ordinary acts of unselfishness, quite ordinary acts of care and concern for each other. So you get this very vivid sense, I think, of them just putting their needs aside and of being of service to each other. And, you know, being of service to the community that they formed. And of course, this can seem quixotic, you know, an ideal that seems, I don't know, too far away from us. I know I often relate to this sutta in this way. It feels like, you know, yeah, it's great in principle, but I don't experience that sort of that often. But having said that, there are occasions that I have experienced something similar in the Sangha. So there's been times when I've been working here, both in Earth Cafe and in the centre team, where for whatever reason it's felt like the conditions have just come together, sometimes just for moments where, I don't know, it's just enabled me to go beyond this sort of small sense of or narrow sense of myself, where I've just felt more in touch with a bigger sense of connection with the bigger picture, a larger sense of mindfulness of what's going on. So I can remember when I worked in Earth Cafe, it was usually at sort of its busiest times when, like on a Saturday lunchtime, when things were just really, really busy. It was like there were just some times when something else would just click into place. It was like there was a bigger sense of mindfulness about the whole situation, about what was needed, about my colleagues, about the people we were serving food to. And I've had it here too in the centre, particularly when we've been preparing, I think, for a big public event like a public ordination. So there's been times, again, in the busyness of preparing for those sort of events where I've just been able to put myself aside and just give to the situation more cleanly, I think. Where there's just been this, you know, a putting aside of my narrow sense of self, my pettiness, any irritations I might have or would usually have with others. Albeit for a moment, I've just been able to sort of set that aside and just have this bigger, more expansive sense of mindfulness of the whole situation and the sort of bigger purpose of what we're trying to do. That's my second point of being provocative. Again, I think this applies to the whole Sangha, not just the men's Sangha, but I think sometimes we do, you know, lack a sort of deeper sense of giving to each other and giving to the situation. You know, I think too easily, and again, I include myself in this, it can be too easy to just get into what's right for my practice, my development, my needs. So I just really encourage you all to, you know, again, if you're up for this, you know, just getting together with groups of your friends and just finding ways to serve the bigger situation in whatever way that might be. You know, get your hands dirty, clean the toilets, clean the tea area, clean the kitchen, sit on reception, you know, train to be a receptionist, support classes, that go on here. You know, sweep the stairs. You know, see it as a practice that could really help you to sort of just try and break down this sort of smaller sense of self, this narrower sense of self, and see it as a way of serving something bigger than us. I know for me that keeping in mind that bigger vision isn't easy, but was really important in those examples that I gave. There was something, I can't describe what it is, but something allowed me to just keep more that bigger vision in mind, that bigger sort of perspective in mind. And I think that's what you get in this sutta. I think you get that sense of the monks being so mindful of both of each other, but also of the bigger sort of principle that they're serving, this bigger principle of Sangha and of cohesion and harmony that they're serving. And they keep that alive through that sort of sense of service, but also by talking about the Dharma. By every few days, they keep alive their talk of the Dharma. So yeah, I just want to finish with a couple of things. Like I say, I know from my years of working here at the centre, trying to keep that bigger vision alive, day in, day out, is really difficult. Whatever situation we might be in, whether it's working here or helping here, or being back at home with family or friends, or in our sort of working situations, sort of outside of this context. It's hard for life not to just sort of feel like this mundane slog, and we lose perspective, a deeper perspective of, bigger sense of what we're trying to do. And all the suttas that I've sort of quoted from, obviously they're the Sangha in relationship, in physical relationship to the Buddha. So I'm assuming that it was easier for them, because they were directly in touch with the Buddha, with the light of the Buddha. That light, I presume, was just much more tangible, much more visible, much more alive than maybe it is for us. So I think we have to try and keep alive, in whatever way we can, that light of the Buddha that we found here as a Sangha, or within the Sangha. And I think we have to try and keep alive, those teachings to help us with the ups and downs of being a Sangha. And we can, do that in different ways. And I just want to suggest one way of doing that. So, we might do that through friendship or through our meditation practice, particularly our Metta Bhavana practice. But we can do that through other ways of using our imagination. And one way to do that is to use the suttas of the Pali Canon. So to use these stories that I've quoted, and there are plenty of other examples of that in the Pali Canon. And this is actually a traditional practice. So on the men's gatherings last year, we did this practice called Buddhana Sati, which is recollecting and keeping the Buddha in mind, usually through a visualization of the Buddha. So we did that a few times in the men's gatherings last year. But we can do that with the other two jewels too, with the Dharma jewel and the Sangha jewel. So we can use these suttas to do a practice called Sanghana Sati. So we can become more familiar with the suttas. We can read them and reread them. We can reflect on them and try and see more deeply what they're telling us, and hear the teachings of the Buddha in relationship to friendship and Sangha. And this could be a way, to deepen our faith in Sangha as a practice, as we see what those who came before us, sort of how they dealt with some of the things we'll encounter in Sangha and friendship as practice. Because Sangha and practice is, it's a joyous experience, and I'm sure we've all had experience of that, but it is a difficult experience too, or it's a difficult practice. It can be very challenging. When things get difficult, when we have a disagreement with somebody or we're hurt and upset by somebody else, it's difficult to just stay in there, to just keep turning up. Our instinct is to pull away usually. And that's exposing. It exposes something of ourselves. And that's the challenge, I think. We have to try and be as grown up as we can in relationship to each other. And that's the challenge, and that's the work and the growth area of Sangha as a practice. And it can, I really do sort of deeply believe that Sangha and friendship can sort of, it is an insight practice. I think it can really help us to break down this sort of fixed sense of self that we sort of go about with. But we have to really want it. We have to really want that. And maybe that's a question that we, you know, continually need to ask ourselves. And if we do want it, you know, I think we need to sort of ask ourselves, well, how do we sort of try and prioritise that in our lives? You know, how do we try and make the effort and the commitment to understand what we're trying to do more clearly and to just keep an active relationship with each other? And I think if we're prepared to do that, one of the things that we'll be as a body of people practicing the Dharma together is that we will be that light in some way for others who come to the centre, who are new, you know, new to the centre. So we'll provide something of that light of the teachings to others. So, you know, new people who come through the doors of the Manchester Centre will see a community that's trying to be deeply honest with each other, is trying to keep in connection and harmony with each other, even when things get very difficult, and is trying to serve and care for each other and serve those people who are coming through the doors. So I think what we do in relationship to each other does have a real impact on both us and on the people of Manchester. Even if it's difficult to just keep that alive in our minds, I think it does have an impact. So finally, I just want to go back to the Angulimala Sutta. And at the end of that, Angulimala is now an enlightened disciple of the Buddha. And the sutta ends with this set of verses from Angulimala. And I just want to sort of finish with the first three verses. Who once was heedless, but later is not, brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. His evil done deed is replaced with skillfulness. He brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. Whatever young monk devotes himself to the Buddha's bidding, he brightens the world like the moon set free from a cloud. Thank you.